Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast, coming from California. Here's Aaron Alvarado and David Stauffer.
Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast. Special episode. We've got a third person with us today, an expert in all things Harry Potter.
Oh, I was like, why is it special? It's because I'm here. That's great.
That's right. That is Shannon Williams of Las Vegas, Nevada, podcasting from Orem, yeah. Utah.
Hello.
And thanks for joining us, Shannon.
You're welcome.
And of course, my co-host as usual, Aaron Alvarado in Los Angeles. Aaron, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm just glad that I don't have to carry the podcast for one single episode. Thank you, Shannon, for being here.
You're welcome.
It's nice to depend on somebody else for a change, because we know David's so not going to do it.
An enormous amount of dead weight here.
Yeah, about 125 pounds soaking wet.
125 pounds. Well, we have a lot to talk about, so I want to get right into it. It's easy for me to get sidetracked wanting to talk about the Sacramento Kings or politics, of two things of which no one wants to hear about. And especially since we have Shannon here. It's always a big event when you have new Harry Potter content, okay? And of course, we're here to talk about the second entry in the Fantastic Beasts series, which is called The Crimes of Grindelwald. I honestly don't even know where to start. But we'll do this. I want to hear just your overall take in terms of your Rotten Tomatoes score that you'd give this movie. And then we're going to tackle it from there. There's several questions that I have for Shannon. Fewer questions that I have for Aaron.
Thank you. Oh, I love hearing that.
And Shannon, why don't you just start us off, your overall takeaway of the film. Did you like it, love it, hate it, and what would you score it on a Rotten Tomatoes 0 to 100?
Okay, so many thoughts. I hate scoring things. I did not like this movie. I'll start there. As far as a score on it, the more I think about it, I'm going to get into this, but I like that it's given us a reason to talk about Harry Potter and this whole world again. So there are aspects that I like about it. But as far as this movie, just on its own, not excusing the fact that there are going to be three more movies to explain what's happening, I don't know, like a 35, or I was really upset when I walked out of this movie.
Wow. 35, yeah, that's pretty low. That's lower than the actual score, which is 40, I believe.
Whoa.
I was not happy.
Well, I think it's worth noting that this is by far the poorest reviewed of all of the Harry Potter films, and it's made the least amount of money so far. It had the smallest opening, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I don't think that should be too surprising, given that it's not a part of the main, you don't have the Daniel Radcliffe and the Emma Watson and the redheaded boy. It's not the main story.
Can we draw the conclusion it's the fact that Johnny Depp is in the movie replacing Colin Farrell? Is that,
oh my gosh,
is that the number one reason why this movie is not good?
No, it's not the number
one. That's what's surprising about it.
I mean, I'm just speaking for myself here. That's the number one reason I didn't like it.
That's the thing. Well, we went into this knowing that this was problematic. Like, we went into this knowing this wasn't going to be good. And not just because Johnny Depp hasn't turned in a good performance in a decade, the better part of a decade, but because he's also a monster who's been, very credibly alleged to have committed domestic assault and violence.
Yep.
Not
he's,
good.
Yep.
He's accused of worse crimes than the actual Grindelwald.
Grindelwald?
So. Oh, that's, yeah. I was going to say, that's the thing here, is the actual character of Grindelwald, quite charming compared to the real Johnny Depp. What really gets me about this casting, and I know a lot has been said about it, is just that it's not just that they picked the wrong person and the worst person, but that they literally had someone infinitely better already in the role in Colin Farrell. And I get it narratively. Yeah. He was playing a different character that was like, surprise, this is Grindelwald. But like, okay, cool. Surprise, it's Grindelwald. But can he still look the same and maybe be portrayed by the same actor?
Yeah.
Because like Colin Farrell is 10x Johnny Depp, 100x Johnny Depp. I mean, it's not even close.
You tell me you couldn't give Colin Farrell just white hair, like gray hair like that, and tell him to play
Oh my gosh.
That seems like the most logical thing to do.
Well, so why don't they just have a different Grindelwald? What if each one of these movies had a different Grindelwald? Like, we already have two movies and two Grindelwalds. Why not go for another, a third? I mean...
And Johnny Depp is in, what, like 5 minutes of the first film? So there's really no reason not to... Even if they didn't want Colin Farrell because he's been... That wasn't the actual Grindelwald. You could have swapped him out for someone else. And it wouldn't made much of a difference.
No. We swapped out Terrence Howard for... in Captain America.
Don Cheadle.
Don Cheadle.
Yeah, for Don Cheadle. And you know what? Do you know how many people complained about that? Zero.
Yeah.
Zero.
Well, to be fair, that was an upgrade. Exactly. There you go.
That's what I'm saying, is that if you have a chance to upgrade, no one's going to care. But also, those 5 minutes of Johnny Depp at the end of Fantastic Beasts were a rough 5 minutes. He looked bad. It was oh, Johnny Depp, he is going through stuff right now. He was a mess.
Yeah.
But JK is like weirdly committed to the casting. So weird.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing that makes me most mad. I mean, I guess, again, we'll get into like JK Rowling and how I don't want to say anything bad about her. Like, I really don't. I really appreciate everything she's done in writing this franchise. But like, I think it's a little bit hypocritical of her with how much of a feminist she is, how she's supported the Me Too movement. With everything on Twitter that she supports, to have her backing Johnny Depp up makes no sense at all. So,
well, I mean, the only sense is, there is a certain millionaire, billionaire class of people that are all very friendly and know each other regardless of political persuasions that, you know.
Yeah.
Or
even
crimes.
As good as her views are.
Yeah. Oh boy.
But it's just like, even J.K. Rowling can't help herself. And that is sad. But speaking of J.K. Rowling, I'm going to keep on going here. Aaron, do you want to give a score? I want to know if you're above or below 35.
So my Rotten Tomato score, I was going to rule it incomplete because the movie just left me completely dumbfounded by the end of it. Is that it? Is it over now? I mean, please, I hope it's over. But yes, okay. Those are the credits. I think I can go now.
Or is there another scene that introduces more new characters and more storyline?
Yeah, more one more character and not another beast. That's like false advertising, I thought. Not many fantastic beasts in this one.
Nope.
I know, Shannon, I know you said you didn't want to say bad things about J.K. Rowling. We should be grateful for everything she's given us. We're talking about her like she's God, but anyway.
I know,
or
sorry.
She's dead.
you need to be upfront, though, is that she can be a great writer, but that doesn't necessarily. Can you guys still see me, by the way?
Yeah.
I blanked out on the screen.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I can hear the train.
Oh, good.
Train's here.
That's the Caltrain into San Francisco. He keeps honking, by the way.
Oh,
because
now we can't.
He'll be back.
There he goes.
Check back in. Yeah.
Yeah. As if two honks isn't enough, he's got to go 12, but you know. Sorry, he or she, the conductor. I have no idea what gender they are. Anyway, J.K. Rowling. We can say that she's a terrific writer. That, you know, that she is an author that is incredibly talented and one of the most creative individuals alive. The world building that she did with the seven novels. I mean, it's really an incredible feat. Okay, now I'm about to compare her to someone that I also think was a creative genius at one point, but has fallen in a major way, and that's George Lucas. Okay, now the Verge has a great article that I totally agree with, where they call out this film as this is J.K. Rowling's Attack of the Clones when it should have been her Last Jedi. There was an opportunity here to have a great middle film. I'm saying middle loosely. There's supposed to be five movies. I honestly don't know what they're going to do. For the next two movies before the fifth one, when they finally get around to this battle between Dumbledore and Grindelwald. Like, what are the next two movies going to be full of? Because I can tell you the second movie was full of no story. I mean, it's just like mythology and backstory for 2.5 hours.
I like that the second movie took place over the course of like one single day, right? That's
I don't know.
I think that's what it was, but it felt like it was going in real time. Like this is we're experiencing the full day, every single moment of that day. It just droned on and on. I couldn't stand it. So yeah, just thinking that there's going to be two more movies in this series before the final battle, it's just mind blowing to me. I can't even imagine how they're going to fill it.
It's so mind blowing. I mean, the amount of stuff they're going to have to cut from this. I mean, is there salvaging this, Shannon? I mean, what's the path to the successful path going forward? Like, are we doomed?
Okay, so I have so many thoughts. So I think what you're getting at is that J.K. Rowling is a great writer, but a terrible screenwriter, at least for this movie. And I really do like the first Fantastic Beasts. But this one is kind of a mess as far as the pacing goes. We can get into different plot details, but there's a whole storyline that's really just a red herring until you figure out who Credence's family actually is.
Quick side note. Do you know how interested I was in finding out who's Credence's family?
Not at all. Zero. 0%.
That's right. So imagine a red herring to what I'm already very uninterested
not
in.
Caring about. This is my thing, though. I just... J.K. Rowling, throughout the Harry Potter series, has placed... There were things in earlier books, like in book four. One of the earlier books, you find this locket that then finally has a meeting in the seventh book and is one of the Horcruxes. And so she doesn't put things in there just for the sake of having stuff. It all means something. So I have a hard time believing that all of these things that feel like a red herring aren't going to mean something later on. So I still think it could be salvaged, but... for this one, just as a standalone film and not considering everything else, it's just a mess.
It's such a mess. But it's a weird type of mess because it's moving the chess pieces. It's like they forgot to tell a story, that this was a movie that, in theory, should be able to be consumed in a self-contained way, right? But instead, it was like moving the chess pieces, exposition, backstory, explaining this, introducing needless number of new characters. Meanwhile, the main character... in this movie is someone they're wholly uninterested in exploring and they have sidelined in a major way. I'm about to go on another tangent here. Just make this Albus Dumbledore story. Make this about Grindelwald and Dumbledore. Let's just own it. What are we doing messing around with Newt Scamander and these beasts? I think I saw three beasts in this movie and it was like nothing like the all the beasts in the first one, which I honestly liked that part of it in the first one. I actually thought it had an element of whimsy and it wasn't as serious and it was kind of fun, but this one was like, no, we're going to get way serious, but we're still going to have this Fantastic Beast branding. We're still going to care about Newt Scamander. We're going to take a character that we didn't realize would be popular and we completely erased his memory and made a really big deal about how he wasn't going to remember anything. And then we're just going to quickly gloss over the fact that, oh, it turns out he actually remembers everything. You know, no biggie. We really needed to bring him back for the sequel. And then sidelined him to do nothing important. It was just like, why? You didn't need to bring him back if you were going to do anything. It's like, why is Eddie Redmayne there? And I am no fan of Eddie Redmayne. Far be it for me to defend the man who stole an Oscar for Michael Keaton. But like everything else in this movie was such trash that I actually think he was kind of good in it. Like the little bits he was in, it was like, oh, this was actually kind of good. But but it's just like this weird, you have these weird set of main characters that like, they, like J.K. Rowling doesn't want to tell that story. She wants to tell the Dumbledore story, but she refuses to make it a Dumbledore movie. It's really weird. But anyway.
I think you make a great point. You make a good point because I also felt that way about the new character. He's not particularly interesting to me, but the story that we're given as the viewer, we're drowning. We're searching for any sort of life server, or a lifesaver or life vest or something. And we have that with Newt. So Newt is our safety net, basically. He's the one that's keeping us afloat in this pointless ocean of story that we're given that just has no, there's no place for us to rest, basically, except for Newt, our old character, that we have a connection to the old story. So that's why they rely on, I think, personally, is just that was my thoughts in the movie. And I just feel like as someone that's not a Harry Potter fan that doesn't understand any of this stuff, any of the backstory, the first movie worked fine. Like, it's just a good, it's a movie that I didn't feel overwhelmed in whatsoever. I felt like, you know, these are interesting characters, interesting enough. I wasn't totally enthralled by them. But this second movie, you absolutely had to see that first movie or else you're completely lost. I saw that first movie and I still mostly felt lost. It's just like, that's just a hallmark of bad writing, bad storytelling in general. And I think overall the movie is just, it's really poorly made, unfortunately.
Well, so, I guess to put a button on my previous point, and Shannon was helpful in tying my, I have so many thought threads that I will remain untied, so forgive me. But the point that I was making earlier about J.K. Rowling is an excellent author. But I just think the two examples we have of screenwriting, in addition to Cursed Child, you know, like, if you're a great writer in one area, it doesn't mean that it translates. And I just think she's actually not only a bad screenwriter, I think she's a terrible one. And so that one, she was able to mostly hide it in the first one. And I think she may have had some co-screenwriters. I may be incorrect in this. I don't know if she was all alone in this. Okay, she doesn't. It's all her.
She was alone. She also, to be fair, didn't write Cursed Child either.
Playwright. Oh, you're right. You're right.
Jack Thorne wrote the play. She came up with like the concept, the story behind it, but she didn't write the actual play.
I see. Okay. So no, that's helpful. That's helpful.
But yeah, but both of the movies.
Two examples.
Were her.
She's 0-2. I mean, the first one, I give a lot of leeway. Screenwriting can't be easy because writing dialogue that's meant to be performed by actors in a movie is a very different thing than writing, you know, like a regular book or novel or anything, you know. And so, give her a chance to warm up to this type of writing. But, man, by the time we got the second one, I think the problem we have here is someone that is enormously powerful, someone that wields a lot of influence, and much like George Lucas in his later days, when he wanted to go and tinker with the old films and release this special edition, you have J.K. Rowling in a room of people that will absolutely not tell her no. No one's going to say, hey, this maybe isn't going to work or this is a bad idea. Like, no, there's no one is telling J.K. Rowling that something is a bad idea. And as a result, we get this script that is just this hodgepodge of, again, just deep mythology that is really inaccessible to non-Potterheads, and it's still somewhat inaccessible to people like me who considers themselves like 30% or 35% Potter, you know? Like, I mean, it was really mind-blowing. We will get to more things that we dislike, though, but I want to inject some positivity. And those of you listening that totally disagree, by the way, with our takes, don't you worry. There is a treat at the end of this pod. Our friend of the pod, Brian Mortensen, beloved B-Mort, as we call him, he loved this movie. He literally said that this movie is the greatest story J.K. Rowling's ever told.
I think she doesn't agree.
But anyway, I actually asked him if he could provide a handful of notes for this pod to maybe give us some material from the other perspective, because I wanted that perspective to be represented. And he ended up sending me a 16-minute audio file, him talking about all the things that he loved about the movie. And I listened to it, and the praise is effusive, and it's absolutely worth playing in its entirety. But I will reserve that for the end of the pod. I would have loved to have interjected spliced little bits here and there throughout it, but I just got it like an hour ago. And so those of you listening, hang on to the end. There's 16 minutes of unadulterated B-Mort, and it's really worth listening to. It's quite a roller coaster. Don't let your kids listen. But anyway... But there were some positives in this film. So I want to get to a few of the bright spots, and then we can get back to diagnosing what went wrong and if whether or not this is a salvageable situation, considering we have three more movies to make. So Shannon, positives.
Yeah, I'm going to get on my list. I have a list. The what I like and what I don't like, what I like is so much shorter. So visually, I think this movie was fantastic. I think it looked amazing. I guess one thing I wanted from Fantastic Beasts, what I liked about the first one was that we're seeing a different world of magic. We've only seen Harry Potter and how magic works in England, and America was so different in the first one. So it's kind of interesting to see how, like, America operates and how their magical society works. There's kind of interesting uses of magic at the beginning. I don't, this is morbid, but like in that thestral carriage that Grindelwald is going off on, he's trying to get away and he fills it with water to like drown the people inside of it. And I'm like, ooh, that's creative. Like, what an inventive way to kill off people. So I appreciated though that I always like the magic in these series and that there's kind of like different spells that we're seeing that we hadn't before. Sure. You mentioned, I really like Newt. I like Eddie Redmayne though. I just think as a character, he's so likable. I like that there's kind of parallels between like his relationship with Dumbledore and the relationship Harry and Dumbledore had. And the young Newt in it.
Newt is likable?
Yeah. Okay. I think he's really cute. He just wants to do the right thing. He's not interested in having any power.
Well, and so therefore, I would argue that he doesn't want to do the right thing or the wrong thing. He just doesn't want to pick a side.
That's fair. And with Newt too, we have that flashback in the movie, and I thought the young Newt was cast so well, and all of his mannerisms and the way he looked, he acted just like Eddie Redmayne. So that was really fantastic casting there. You can go off on it. You can stop me at any point.
It was funny because I thought the same thing. I was like, how did they find a kid that could do a spot on Eddie Redmayne? And then I thought, like, I guess any awkward 15-year-old kid is Eddie Redmayne. You're right, though. Actually, it was kind of uncanny. At first, I thought it was Eddie Redmayne in prosthetics. But I was just like, wow, they really casted a kid. Like, I hope he can act, because they clearly casted someone that just was, they couldn't resist casting because he spot on physically looked like him. But, yeah.
Yeah. And I can save these for the end, but I guess the biggest thing that I liked about this, even if I don't like the ending, I don't like a lot of the things that came out of this film, but I love that now all the Harry Potter fans are now going off on these crazy theories about whether Credence is Dumbledore's brother, all of the things that don't make sense in the movie, they're now trying to make sense of. That's something that we haven't... I was so into the Harry Potter books, and we haven't had that since books 5 and 6. And there was just such a fervor at that time to, like, figure out who the Half-Blood Prince would be, and, you know, did Snape actually mean to kill Dumbledore, and was he good or bad, or, you know, that... We haven't had that in a long time. So the first Fantastic Beasts did not do that and leave it open to theory, so... That's kind of exciting.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't really think of it. What's interesting about these movies is that we don't, you know, the source material didn't come, you know, first. We don't have these books to base it off of. But even still, the mythology that they chose to explore and go down, and again, this is coming from a non-Potterhead, I just thought was interesting. Like, there's a reveal at the end, and we're going full spoiler here.
Yes, I already spoiled it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. No.
You can't spoil this movie. You cannot spoil it. It's already spoiled.
Yeah, no, spoiler alert. It's a bad movie. It's not a fun watch. Not a good hang. But when they built up this big moment and this announce, you know, like he says it in this way that was like so weirdly stilted and also like, oh, that was supposed to be a big deal, I think. Yeah, they meant for that to be a big deal. Ah, gosh, I just don't feel like and this is coming from more my ignorance of like the significance of Dumbledore having a long lost brother, but also I'm just kind of like, what about my boy Newt? Does he have a long lost like this is Newt's movie? It's named after him and his beast.
It's like, not Newt's movie.
Can we get a little bit
anymore?
More backstory on Newt? Like, who cares about Dumbledore's brother? He's supposed to be a side character. This is the Fantastic Beasts movie. But again, that just goes back to my previous point about how like. How uninterested J.K. Rowling is in telling a story about Newt Scamander, yet refusing to abandon the branding that belongs to him. Did you mention Dumbledore in your pot?
I don't think J.K. Rowling's like confident enough to leave Hogwarts behind, because that's what everyone has cared about. So I cared about the characters in Fantastic Beasts, but she's so invested in the ones from the Harry Potter series that she's not willing to let them go, I think. I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't talk about Dumbledore, but that was another highlight.
So this is, I guess, calling back to my Last Jedi versus Attack of the Clones analogy, like, this is kind of like Rian Johnson, The Last Jedi, making Rey no one and being like, anyone can be a Jedi, you know, like, this, like, the world is bigger. This is the complete opposite. This is like, Credence isn't just some random person with these power, you know, Obscurial or whatever. He's has to be related to someone significant, and that builds up to this big moment. And it was just like, I actually don't like that. I wouldn't have liked it if Rey were related to someone significant. And I already don't care about Credence. That's a big difference here. I cared about Rey from the get-go, but like Credence is the worst version of Ezra Miller. You can imagine. Like, take someone as charismatic as Ezra Miller and force him to play that character. And I mean, I can imagine for Ezra, it's hard. It's even harder
He's
on the
so
audience
misused.
That has to watch it. Yeah, it's not good. But it's just kind of like, yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, Stoffer, you'll be so proud of me because I made that exact same comparison to a friend today about Rey and her lineage.
So,
because my theory is, one of my theories is that they're going to undo, like, they're saying now that Credence is Dumbledore's brother, but I think Grindelwald is just lying. So I think it's going to do the opposite. And I'm really worried with Star Wars that J.J. Abrams is going to go back and say, no, Rey is someone important. And I will be so mad. But with Harry Potter, with this series, I feel like they're going to do the opposite and just say, oh, we made it up. Like, and I have, like, reasons behind why he might do that. But
they made
my
it
thought
too big of a deal. They built it up. We had an entire subplot of figuring out who he was related to. Like, to throw that away would be a big deal.
My thought is that Grindelwald, he knows right now that he can't fight Dumbledore because of this blood pact, which is a whole other convoluted issue with this movie.
Yeah, can we? Yes. That's among my negatives, by the way, is that a pinky promise is keeping the two most powerful wizards from battling and one from saving the world. It's like, well, when we were kids, we had a pinky promise under the oak tree. It's like, buddy, you're an adult now. Like, the world is at stake. Maybe a pinky promise shouldn't be, you know, the thing that keeps you from saving everyone.
But I think he maybe wants to use Credence because as the Obscurial, he's so powerful, like we saw in the first one, that he just destroys everything and doesn't really have control over it. I think he wants to give Credence motivation to try to destroy Dumbledore so that Grindelwald doesn't have to do it.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But yeah, so he made it all up, which will be lame if that's going to happen, but it's still what I think is going to happen.
Sorry. Train. Another train coming by the station, if you can't hear that. Dumbledore. Did you mention Dumbledore as one of your positives?
Yeah. Or I haven't, but I was going to. So let's talk about
I didn't know if you were done or not. Sorry, continue.
I was go. We should talk about Jude Law being great.
Okay, let's do it. So we have three... So we've had three Dumbledores in Harry Potter cinema, right? We've had Richard Harris, who was he one or two movies?
One and two.
And then we had Michael Gambone, who I don't know how you feel about Shannon about Michael Gambone, but most of my Harry Potter friends really disliked his portrayal of Dumbledore.
I really dislike his portrayal of Dumbledore. Okay.
Yeah.
That is accurate.
I'm no purist, but like I couldn't help but feel like he really got it all wrong. It really came from like, it really seemed like he hadn't read any of the books and really didn't know anything about this.
He didn't.
But Jude Law is the first time where I feel like, in the case of Jude Law, I do feel like this is the first time someone's like, oh, they actually did character research. Like, he's actually trying to evoke the type of temperament and mentality and demeanor of the Dumbledore you read about in the book, but that, you know, a younger, more charismatic version. I actually feel like he nailed it. And that was like really refreshing. That was a huge positive for me in this film.
Agreed. I still think Richard Harris is probably my favorite. it. He didn't have as much material to work with in those first two, but he is just what I imagine Dumbledore to be. But I think Jude Law gets a lot right. Like I was saying, the relationship between him and Newt, I feel it just makes sense with what you've read about him and Harry Potter that he kind of, I don't know, he's taking these people, Dumbledore, this gets into the whole lore of it, but him and Grindelwald both wanted to find the Hallows, so they became Masters of Death. So Dumbledore was someone who's aware that he wants all of this power, and he tends to go to the people who don't actively seek that power. So he is at least humble enough to realize what his weakness is and go to the person. So anyway, it made sense with how Dumbledore is characterized in other books to me. And he's kind of mischievous. You know, he had that like glove at the beginning that comes out and kind of beckons Newt to join him. And I don't know, he's always been kind of like a little bit silly. And so, yeah, all of it made sense to me.
But also, like, you could tell, I think it was, is it Lita?
Lita.
I'm trying to remember. Yes. I think it was the conversation that he has with her where he's asking her a series of questions that you can tell that he's like, he's being kind of intellectually manipulative. Like, it's almost kind of like he's trying to get people to, you know, like, it's like, oh, this is someone that's like a leader that knows how to get people to do the thing they want them to do without telling them, like, you know, commanding them, like trying to get them to figure it out themselves. Like, I just think the way he interacted with people is very like, oh yeah, this is how Dumbledore, and this is how the, you know, like the head of Hogwarts, it had to have been someone like that. So I was a big fan of that. Speaking of Hogwarts, one of the positives for me was, and this is actually, it's bad that this was such a positive, but I really had a moment when they went back to the Hogwarts castle that I was like, oh yeah, this is what it's like to have fun in this world again. And there was specifically the scene where in the background you see the Quidditch match being played and they go by on the broomsticks. And I don't want to say my heart skipped a beat, but there was like, it almost like took my breath away. Like, oh yeah, that's right. This is like this beautiful, cool, fun, incredible world that's got incredible stories to tell. And we're stuck trying to figure out who Credence's mommy and daddy is.
I know.
You gotta be kidding me. It was bad because it reminded me of how good these could be. But in the moment, it felt cool, you know. But it's nostalgia. That's a play of nostalgia. It's not good storytelling.
Oh yeah.
But it's a reminder of the incredible world J.K. has created.
So. Well, isn't that the whole point of this series, though? The extension or the prequels is to remind you that, oh look, we're still in the universe. So that's like basically it's all fan service. Like you said, like that's one of the best moments in the movie is going back to Hogwarts, which doesn't really serve that much of a purpose to drive the story forward.
It is an opportunity to explore more, though. To Shannon's earlier point about getting out of England, because all we've seen up to this point, before the first Fantastic film, was how the magic world worked in England, right? So seeing America, even in the 1930s or whatever it was, in the first Fantastic Beasts film, it was like, oh, this is actually kind of cool. They have their own magic council. Things are done a little bit differently. And then in this one, we saw France primarily, I think.
I love the fact that they, like one of the major plot points of the start of the movie is that Newt is not allowed to leave the country again. Like that's huge. It's a big deal. He goes in front of a council and he is forbidden from leaving the country. And all it takes is
a portkey.
Yeah, exactly. All it takes is just knowing the right guy, basically, to just get out of that.
Yeah.
To get out of that ban. No biggie. No biggie. I'll just throw some gold coins at this guy and he'll get me out of here. Perfect.
It's like I don't know how much time has passed between the first and second Fantastic film. But, like, I really hope Newt wasn't just waiting around for the, I'm imagining the,
for a
council. Excruciating slow judicial process of getting that hearing. Like, dude, if you know homeboy on the black market over by the cliffs, like, just you know, go find Tina and tell her that you still, you know, are digging her and just, like, go take care of that. But, like, I mean, Newt says it himself, he has no side. Yeah. Why? What are you waiting for rules for? I mean, he's, like, he knew that they weren't going to grant him.
Can I get a refresher? Why does the girl that he likes, I can't remember any of these people's names, so I apologize.
Catherine magic, Robinson, I think Tina.
Yeah, exactly. There you go, Tina. So why is she mad at him?
That's a good question. Deal?
Again, a product of a half-baked like plot line that like they didn't really care about.
Oh. Yeah, she saw like a wizard tabloid saying that, so we know that Newt kind of had a thing for Leta Lestrange, and so there's a wizard tabloid that says that Newt and Leta are now engaged, and Tina believes it, but Leta's actually engaged to the brother. So yeah, it doesn't make sense, though. It doesn't go deeper into why she ends up with the brother. They show the flashback to show why Newt and Leta, that they had this friendship and relationship, but they don't show how the brother comes into it at all. And then, spoiler, Leta dies, and so we don't know. We're never going to know that story, so it feels cool. Like there's no point in putting it in. I don't know. So
it's completely, we'll never know. Completely pointless. It's both pointless and, like, the little time that they do spend on these characters that they don't really care about, like, they spend it in all the wrong ways. Like, in the moments of exposition where they're explaining that she saw this tabloid and da da da, I'm thinking, like, a tabloid? You're a wizard and a witch. Like, is there not a FaceTime spell to just make a quick phone call? Like, be like, hey, Newt, this is interesting. I saw this tabloid thing. I thought we had a thing going, and maybe, like, clarify it immediately. Yeah. Like, is tabloid really the best way of transferring information in a magical world? Like, are we serious? Like, Tina, Newt. Yeah. I mean, I'd put it on Newt.
Get it, like, together.
Yeah, yeah, that just seems like a misunderstanding that could be really taken care of with one simple conversation saying, yeah. No, I'm not engaged to this girl. So
news alert, news flash, tabloids were incorrect. And maybe you should be giving me the benefit of the doubt. Like, what are we doing? So speaking of Tina, her sister Queenie, can we talk about Queenie for a second?
Yeah. The thing that makes me most mad.
It does it?
If I have one stick, this is the thing I'm most upset about.
Are you upset about her putting on a very problematic spell on our friend Jacob? Or is it
everything
to the dark side?
She was so I dressed up as Queenie when I went to see the movie. She was my favorite from the first movie.
So by the end of the film, were you like Team Grindelwald or no? Was it not?
No, I'm just mad because none of her actions were consistent with what happened in the first movie. She was like bubbly, but still smart. In the first movie, she breaks him out of the Ministry of Magic and basically saves everyone. In this movie, she just comes off very ditzy, obsessed with getting married. She ends up crying in the middle of the street. And
well, yeah, now I know why you dressed up like her.
I probably would, but I she turns over to Grindelwald's, which they start having like the seeds of motivation for her to do that, but they don't really follow through on
I was gonna ask you, what were those? Because I felt like, I'm trying to remember, is like, did I have a restroom break in the movie? Because like, I can't for the life of me recall a clear motivation for her going to the dark side.
So she's in love with Jacob, and they're not in America. Wizards and witches are not allowed to marry no mages. But she's in love and she wants to get married. And so, I mean, obviously that's not great, but it's interesting that the problem with that is if that's really what she wants and she thinks, no, I want the freedom to do this, so I'm going to go to someone who wants more freedom for wizards, she leaves Jacob in order to do it, the man that she's so in love with that she can't stand not being married to him. So it doesn't really make sense for her to just all of a sudden leave him in order to support this cause. I don't know.
I don't know either. The motivation just does not make sense at all. It's not consistent. No. At all.
Yeah.
It was almost like they lined up all the characters, like, hey, how many we have on the good side and the bad side? Like, we gotta throw a bone to the bad side. Like I'm imagining the writer's room, they just have this like board of like, you know, little faces taped on, and they move them, you know, so they move Queenie across the board to the bad side, like, well, we have to have a good reason. It's like, yeah, we'll come up with something. And then they like didn't actually come up with something. Motivation, but not,
I don't know what. Was there something in that tea she drank? I don't know.
That's what I'm hoping. Because the pot keeps coming along trying to give her more tea. And so my hope is that they were just spelling her into going out over spell. His side. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, no, she's Queenie's in the second place.
Bring those universes together.
I'll watch that.
So before getting to Aaron's exhaustive list of positives, and by the way, we are technically still talking about positives, which has been 85% negative.
Oh, are we?
I love that. Well, did you have anything else on your list, Shannon, that you wanted to hit on?
Oh, gosh. positives or just my list in general? The positives have been done. We're good. Okay. I'm good.
I named all of mine as well. Aaron?
Yeah. Aaron.
I have two positives. One is you guys kind of already touched on it. It's Dumbledore suits. I think his style, impeccable. I mean, that.
Yeah, it's incredible.
He's got it. There you go.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Jude Law.
He's got the coat in that one, but you can't see the three-piece suit. It's nice.
Yeah. and number two. Y'all, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, can I tell you, at the Lucid office, everyone's sticking point after this movie, like everyone was most mad about the inconsistency of Dumbledore's clothing. They said, look at him in the later movies. How did he go from these like hot three-piece suits to, you know, bedazzled muumuus? Well, it was so funny.
I don't know about you guys, but I mean, my grandparents weren't exactly, you know, fashion forward. So I think it's a pretty easy explanation. Old people don't dress good.
I was not worried about
it. Comfort over style after a certain point.
Dumbledore in the early movies, in the Harry Potter movies, is basically wearing sweatpants. That's the equivalent of like the Wizard in sweatpants. He's done.
So the other thing that I did like was it's fleeting. It's only a couple scenes, but when they go into the storage area of the beasts in Newt's basement, like all that stuff was really cool to see all the animals back in the habitat that he created for them. That was fun. It was like, this is the
baby Nifflers.
All that stuff was funny. And it's like, that's the big selling point. It's part of the title of the movie. Maybe we can go revisit that. Nope.
Mm-mm. I can't tell you. Oh, you're getting me all worked up again, because I can't tell you how badly I would really want five movies of Newt just whimsical travels across the world.
Yep. You know,
yes, with Tina. Yes, with Queenie. Sure, Jacob, bring him along. How about let's erase his memory after every movie and then bring it? Like, I would even be down with that. Like, the ongoing joke is like Jacob doesn't remember everything. But like,
it's a better story. That's a better story. More potential there.
I'm telling you, the beast stuff. Look, we've already gotten the light and the dark Harry Potter type movies, but to have those ones that are carefree and allow you to explore the world, have some fun. Yes, you can have some gravity. You know, you can have some story that means something. But why are we already, the second film into the spinoff series, bogged down in Dumbledore lore? Like, what are we doing? Like, why can't we see the Wizarding World in South Africa and how that works, right? Like why can't we go to New Zealand? Why can't we, you know, like, I want to see the travels. I want to see just the formula of Newt landing in New York City, accidentally letting his beasts out, all heck breaks loose as he tries to gather them up. Like, that's fun. Like, that's a fun, and it's, you know, you have these fun set pieces. It's common. It's, you know, it's very popcorn cinema, but like, I'm all in for that, as long as it's exploring more of the Wizarding World. But man, we are not exploring anymore. It's such a bummer.
I would rather see a movie about that circus freak show with the snake lady. Give me that movie.
Yes.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, and like, did we need to know where Voldemort's snake came from, by the way? Because like, this is the type of thing I'm talking, like the bogging down of mythology. I don't know if you know this, Aaron, but like, that apparently, mm-hmm. like that character, the woman that plays that snake,
and it makes it even worse, because you consider one of the best parts of movie 7 is when Neville beheads the snake.
Well, that's all,
and now we know it's this poor woman that's been cursed.
Every time she's on the screen, I'm just imagining Bucktooth and Neville from the first Harry Potter movie being like, oh, he's going to cut her head off. Like, she's going to have a bad ending. Like, wow.
Yeah, it was, I don't know if you felt this way about Solo too. I'm assuming you probably did based on what you said about that. But I felt the same way about Solo, that there were so many things they explained that I never needed to know about.
Oh, I can't tell you. I just about walked out when he got his last name assigned to him for being by himself. It's like, oh, we needed to explain
that
this.
That was the worst.
Oh my gosh, this is going to be like.
But it's that same principle. I don't think she has to explain where every single little thing comes from. Sometimes a snake is just a snake, and we should be okay with that.
Seriously. Well, anyway, we've got a big battle that's coming up between Dumbledore and Grindelwald. Clearly, that's all they're talking about. And we're three movies away. Three movies away.
Like, so I have a question. Do you guys think, so I remember this line, or basically a paraphrase for the movie, where they asked them, I think Newt asked Dumbledore, he's like, so you guys were like brothers? And Dumbledore says, no, we were closer than brothers. Like, what does that mean? So, do we know what that means?
So?
They're in love.
I mean, oh! So B-Mort goes in on this.
Like, legitimately.
So in his 16-minute diatribe, I'll call it. Now, in his 16-minute monologue that those listening on the audio version, not the Facebook Live version, but those listening on the audio pod will hear, one of his few qualms with the film is that they didn't more explicitly own the fact that Grindelwald and Dumbledore were gay, that they alluded to it, but still tiptoed. It was like, why are we tiptoeing still? I mean, it's knowledge, if it's common knowledge. And
oh, is that understood? And, I don't know. And, I didn't know.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, kind of.
It came
right?
out.
Like it,
yeah.
Well, it hasn't explicitly been said in any canonical like book or film, but J.K. Rowling has said that like publicly, right? Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, it happened. So book 7 has a whole lot of like Dumbledore backstory in it. And that's when they kind of go through the relationship that Dumbledore and Grindelwald had, how they were both trying to find the Deathly Hallows and inadvertently ended up killing Dumbledore's sister, all of this stuff. Then after the book, they said, oh, well, it seems like there was something, like a fan said, it seems like there was something more going on. And that's when J.K. Rowling said, oh, yeah, they were in love. And it's annoying at this point. Again, I feel like it's kind of queer baiting, a little bit hypocritical, that if you've said, oh, Dumbledore's gay, then why don't you just own it and have
either
that show?
Do it or don't do it. Like, what are we doing? Like,
And I was... there were moments of it. I felt like you could really feel it at certain points, but I guess if Aaron didn't know that, then people who don't like already know this about the Harry Potter series maybe weren't picking up on it. The fact that Grindelwald appeared in the Mirrorverse said I was kind of excited about, because Dumbledore's always kind of made up things like, oh, when I look, it's supposed to be the thing you most desire. When he's looked at it, he said, oh, I see a pair of socks, or he like makes up things. You're like, that can't really be the real thing, and it's because it was Grindelwald and he was sort of hiding it, is what I assumed. But you can just as easily assume that they're showing the blood pact because his greatest desire is not to have the blood pact anymore either. So I don't know, there are moments where I thought, yeah, that is pretty clear, but they could have had them kiss, they could have done so many other things to make it just more explicit.
Yeah, they're not going to be kissing in any of these movies. It's not going to happen.
I mean, now that it's Johnny Depp, I don't want that to happen. No one wants to see that.
So this means like we're going to get more of their relationship in upcoming movies then. Is that?
Oh, yeah.
Is that, I'm hoping.
Is that what they're leading to? Okay.
I fully expect that we won't have Newt by movie 4 or 5. I think they'll just phase those characters out. Like, they're gone. Like, I don't think it's going to be their story.
I think he's using Newt, though. What I'm thinking the next movie is going to be is Newt and Dumbledore now trying to figure out how to get rid of this blood pact. But yeah, I don't know. I hope there's more about the relationship, because I feel like having a blood pact keep them from finding each other is way less interesting than having them being attracted to each other keep them
absolutely
from fighting each other.
Absolutely.
You know
what
I mean?
That makes way more sense.
That's
why,
way
why
more
give
interesting.
Them,
I think it's a more compelling story.
Yeah. Why give them a literal, a physical token?
I don't know.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
Unless you're never going to say that they're explicitly together. Which,
well, ding, ding, ding. I mean, yeah. They're never going to say
I don't
it.
Know.
Not in a movie.
Yeah, that's irritating.
Well, we should probably start wrapping up. But what other takes do you have, Shannon?
We have a comment. I don't know. Do you see that?
No, we'll get to the comment. We'll get to the comment.
Okay, dear. Okay. Yeah, let me think of a few. Well, do you want me to say? There's a couple of other things. Just knowing like Harry Potter stuff that. Theories that have come about that I find that more interesting than the movie itself.
Well, give Aaron and I something to hold on to here.
Please do.
Like,
yeah.
Save me.
Yeah. So I, like I said, I don't think that Credence is actually Dumbledore's son, and that Dumbledore is enlisting Newt to try to help fight. Like, they're each getting their partner to try to lead up to this big fight, right? So he's just trying to get Credence to fight him. There's a whole lot of Grindelwald, like, manipulating people at every point, that it makes perfect sense that he wouldn't be the one, or that he would be lying about this. Another thing, though, with that, so... Again, so much stuff. Dumbledore had a sister who couldn't... She was assaulted when she was younger because some muggles found her using magic. And so she was actually an obscurial, like Credence is. Because that's what makes that happen to you, is that you, like, are hesitant to use magic, and so you become this thing that you have no control over the magic anymore. So there's been theories about the sister, like, Credence's Obscurus is actually the sister's Obscurial that kind of connected to her in some way. Which, again, that's kind of interesting. We do know Dumbledore has some siblings, so it's like, well, it would make more sense that it's that family coming in instead of just this new long-lost brother that came out of nowhere. The whole Lestrange red herring thing, honestly, I was so irritated by, because we have this whole convoluted story about babies switching on the Titanic, and may or may not be the Titanic, but
it's the Titanic.
Lestrange.
The movie itself was the Titanic.
Yeah. Exactly. But it was definitely the Titanic. I was like, yeah, no other ship it could have happened on.
But they do. So Bellatrix Lestrange is a character that comes later on that we all know. So with Corvus, this baby that supposedly died, they claim that he was the last in this line. And then if you have Leta, who's died, that would end the line. But we know we have Lestrange people later on. So either Corvus actually has to exist, Leta has to be alive, which I would hate because it would be another fake out. But that whole red herring of a story about this baby switching, I think, is still going to come along later, because that kid went somewhere. I don't think he's died. He has to come back into it. So again, I'm just saying, like, I think Rowling's planting seeds of stuff, and right now it makes no sense, which doesn't make this a great movie, but I'm hoping that, like, what's planted now will hopefully create a better story later on.
She's planting a lot of stuff, and I'm afraid none of very little of it will bear fruit.
I don't know.
So we do have a comment. You want to talk about this, Aaron? It's from our friend Beto Gonzalez. He wants to know if we have already discussed how Eddie Redmayne's lips are the same color as the rest of his face, which we have. We're happy to go over it again. And what that says about his character's motivation. I do. There is a backstory here to why that is. I don't know if you guys know the story.
I don't know that one. Let's hear it.
No.
So Eddie Redmayne was in the film with Channing Tatum and Mila Kunis. It was a famously awful film. I'm forgetting the name of it. Something Odyssey... No, it was like famously directed.
Are you talking about Jupiter Ascending?
Jupiter Ascending. There it is. Not
nice pull, so Shannon. Right on.
I have a friend who loves that for being a terrible movie. Oh, yeah. I've never seen it.
Right. It's become like a cult favorite because of how bad it is. Yeah. It is really bad. And Eddie Redmayne, this was my first experience with him before, I got to know him for the movie in which he won the Oscar. So ridiculous. I can't believe he won an Oscar for that film. Like, that's, gosh, I'm telling you, I could win an Oscar right now. I could honestly win an Oscar in my sleep. And in this chair right here, actually. But anyway, so Jupiter Ascending, Eddie Redmayne's the bad guy, and he had these prosthetic lips applied that were the same color as his face. But the makeup people screwed up, and they applied it with a permanent, like a super glue. So he's never, every film he's had the same, his lips the same color as his face, which was that character's look. So they just, it just is, it's there. Stuff.
Freak accident. Yeah. Wow. That's terrible. Yeah.
Are you serious?
That sounds made up. Lipstick, so it was fine, but like the rest of his films, it hasn't worked out.
So he's basically like the real life Joker. We don't know if he's wearing makeup or if the skin tone is the makeup.
Yeah. Want to know how I got these lips? I really don't think Eddie Redmayne's a good actor at all, but I do think he's a good Newt Scamander. Like, I actually do think that this, like,
he's so charming, though. I am charmed by him.
Charming?
I find him charming.
By his real life persona or Newt Scamander?
Both. Newt specifically, I think, is, like, so awkward that I find him charming.
Yeah, no, I think that's the
I've
best
got a type. Skinny,
Eddie.
Awkward, yeah. White dude. That would be my type.
Well, I mean, yeah, you would have loved me in high school, I tell you what. I've never seen a performance I've enjoyed him in other than this. I actually do think he plays this kind of oblivious, like, I just want to care about my animal. Like, I don't want to care about, like, I don't want to get involved in this stuff. Like, I actually buy that. But, yeah, I don't, outside of this role, I don't know that Eddie's cut out to be an actor.
he's got a very specific range, doesn't he? He's limited. Yeah. I'll just put it that way. He's limited.
Yeah. Yes, very limited. Are there mythology things that you want to hit on, Shannon? I know B. Mort is going to hit on a bunch of stuff in his 16-minute monologue that he's really excited about.
Is this now a... Yeah. Is this become a competition of I need to hit it before he does?
No, that's fine.
Yes.
No, another... I'll bring up two other things because I think that he'll probably bring up McGonagall, I'm assuming.
He does.
Maybe. There's a complaint. McGonagall is not... People have traced it back. She was born after this story happened, so it doesn't make sense to have her in the movie. There's just an interesting theory that she has a time turner and has gone back in time. I don't think they ever said her first name, though, so I'm thinking it could just be another McGonagall. I don't know. I wrote that off as an inconsistency at first, but again, J.K. Rowling's really detail-oriented. I just can't imagine that she's like, we'll just throw her in there, and she didn't think through that she's not in this time, but maybe. And then there's
Be more, I don't know if you're listening, but if you can hear, that's the sound of your thunder getting stolen.
Boom.
He goes he is like beside himself.
I'm gonna snap it as much as possible.
I love it.
And the other one, just like listening to a lot of theories about it, Nicholas Flamel, my friend Catherine thinks there's
this
more
the
to
alchemist.
This too, because yeah, so we have like a little bit of a Nicholas Flamel cameo in it, which I thought, oh, that's like great for fans of the book. He created the Sorcerer's Stone, and so we've heard about him, but we've never seen him in the Harry Potter series. So I was thinking, oh, like that's just kind of a fun cameo in it, but the Sorcerer's Stone does make you immortal, and this is what Grindelwald and Dumbledore were pursuing, and that's kind of how Dumbledore knows him. The Sorcerer's Stone is on the cover of, there's a whole screenplay too. Like, if you wanted to, you could read the screenplay for this movie. I really dig deep to it.
I know what I'm doing for our White Elephant gift exchange.
But the stone is on the cover too, and so people are like, maybe that wasn't just like fan service having it in there, but maybe that'll come about. The characters will use it, or there's more to it than just making you immortal, and it might help defeat Grindelwald. I don't know. That's all I'm
throwing
out there.
In the movie, are they going to call it the Sorcerer's Stone or the Philosopher's Stone? That's my question.
I don't know why they changed it to begin with. At the beginning of the series, they changed a bunch of stuff for us dumb Americans who I guess weren't going to understand.
It makes no sense. English. Like, that
I know. It's like you could have kept it and everyone would have been fine.
Can I say though about Nicholas Flamel guy that just reminds me of his introduction. His scene was weirdly awkward and stilted. Like, it was so sudden. I was like, oh, he just kind of comes into frame and starts talking. And I was like, oh, I guess
he gets his hand
broken. But we don't. It struck me as the type of scene that, and I think I heard someone theorize this on a podcast, and I totally agree that like they cut a scene where they arrived and that had some scene with him and they had to do like. They had to do some pickup shooting to reintroduce him because they had to cut a bunch of minutes off or something like that, because his intro was like really bizarre and weird. I'm like, and honestly for me, quite frankly, a little terrifying because he looked really scary.
Yeah. A little bit, like, again,
like
I don't
the Last Crusade in guy, but, yeah.
Yeah, in this movie, I don't think it serves any purpose rather than just having Nicholas Flamel in it, but it might come later.
That's
I
kind of
know.
The theme of the whole movie. Like, what purpose does it serve?
That's, yes. The theme of the movie is, hey, remember Harry Potter, this awesome thing that we did? Like, remember that awesome thing that we did?
Yeah.
Like, that's what we've been talking about. We're going to remind you about the awesome thing. Ah, I can't, this is making me wish that they could do movies that doesn't reference a single known character. Like, yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. And another, like, infuriating thing about it, too, is that was it also David Yates that directed this one? He did the first one.
Yeah,
I think he did this one, too.
Yeah.
He did my favorite Harry Potter movie.
Which one?
My favorite, this makes me weird, it's 7 Part 1. It's like the first half of Deathly Hallows is my favorite. But yeah, so he's done like the best of the best and then the worst. And so that's really infuriating.
Now, David Yates, didn't he do 5, 6 and the 2 7s or just 6 and the 2 7s?
6 and the 2 7s.
It was 6 and the 2 7s. I guess I don't know.
Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was 5-2. I don't either.
I don't know.
Maybe you're right. You're
but
probably
he's done,
right.
He's definitely done the first two Fantastic Beasts, and David Yates at this point is getting paid. We know he knows how to make a good movie. Like, I actually think David Yates can be a talented visual filmmaker, but it just, like, he doesn't – I mean, there are visuals in this movie that are kind of interesting, a lot fewer than the first Fantastic Beasts film. I think the visuals really helped make that – for me, it exceeded the first one exceeded my kind of medium to low expectations, and a lot of that had to do with his direction and the visuals, but like this one was I feel like decidedly more kind of dumbed down, I guess. Just felt, I don't know, even from the color to the bleakness to the like the amount of like relying on his
I appreciate the fact that speaking of the visuals, I mean, they're gonna make a movie in Paris and show nothing attractive about the city, one of the most beautiful cities in the world in the history of civilization, but yeah, let's just make it look bleak and like a bunch of back alleys. It's a bold choice for sure.
This cultural melting pot of, you know,
yeah, like please show me another cobblestone road. Appreciate that.
Yeah, that's funny.
And a mausoleum. Yeah, thank you.
So maybe we end on this part of the discussion. Unless there's anything else, I don't know how robust your notes were, Aaron. If you had anything left. Yeah. On
I mean, I have 3 more pages, but you guys basically have touched on all the points that I was gonna make.
It's all Creedence material. It's all please tell me that they're all Creedence Clearwater Revival jokes. And you just pull pages after pages.
No, I was gonna say I thought Creedence was the character from The Office, the old guy from The Office.
Creed.
Oh.
Yeah.
Also the best Rocky movie. Creed.
Have you seen that parody? They have a parody. It's Fantastic Beats and Where to Find Them, and it's Dwight's face on Eddie Redmayne's body. It is pretty funny.
Oh, my gosh.
I like that.
Just quick tangent, Shannon. Just want to make sure we're on the same page here. As great as Parks and Recreation is, and it's in the Pantheon, The Office is clearly the overall better show.
The Office is my favorite. It depends on, I really think The Office dips off after season 6.
Yeah,
and I think
fair.
Parks and Rec stays solid throughout. But like the best of The Office is the best of the two.
Yes.
That is a tangent.
No, sorry. You had
important.
You're talking Creed. It's important. Yeah. No, it's a
I know.
Very real thing.
We
this
have
is,
to really...
And I
I've been rewatching both, and I really like, you know, I like both of them so much.
Well, what's funny is we'll get more texts and messages about this question than anything else in this episode. So, yes, people feel pretty fired up about this this take. But anyway, Shannon, I want to know for you what does redemption look like for this series? Like, what could the next movie possibly do that would get you re-engaged again and encouraged again? Like, what would it need to do? What story would it need to explore? Or what would it need to cut? What characters or story? Like, whether taking away or adding, like, what... If it's salvageable for you, what's... Like, walk me through that path.
Question. I think you've got to save Queenie. I am still upset about that. I think there's got to be some reason behind her going to the other side. That's not the only thing,
Queenie's
but
gonna
like
die,
I want
though. She's
I want that
die.
Fixed. Yeah, she. You know, that's a good question. I think just what I've been saying, like, I want this stuff that feels like it doesn't matter to matter, at least some of it. And I hate fake out deaths and fake out reveals. And so
and
I don't
fake out memory losses. Yeah.
Yeah. I Infinity War this year made me so mad because the whole thing, it's like you go into it and you know that the whole ending of that is not real. And so
yeah,
I don't,
yeah. It's insulting. To the
yeah.
Audience,
that's,
is, but.
Yeah, so I just don't want any of that. I do like your idea. I think it would be great if... I think these movies, each one of them is supposed to be set in a different country. So that's why we went from New York to Paris in this one. So I would like to see like more from different countries and different types of magic and whatnot. More new, just with his creatures taking care of him. I don't know. The direction it's going in, there was so much Dumbledore stuff in the seventh book, which is my favorite of the Harry Potter series, but I didn't think we needed more. They really explored that path pretty thoroughly, I thought, so I don't know why we're getting a whole lot more of it.
Well, that, you know what, we are getting, if there's one thing I feel pretty confident about after this film is that we're getting less Newt and more Albus Dumbledore going forward.
Yeah.
That's clearly the story they've pivoted towards telling, which is unfortunately the less interesting one. So you want redemption for Queenie. You want
everything
more
to make sense. I want,
yeah,
I want
a coherent narrative would be.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is that asking too much? I don't know.
I would like them to take Jacob back to New York because this guy never signed up for any of this to begin with. Okay, this is an innocent bystander. I want them to take him back to New York. Okay, none of the, like if Queenie's spell that made him fall in love, that worked really like a lot better than the spell that was supposed to make him forget all this stuff. So like let's get him back to New York and actually bring out a freaking effective spell that actually makes him lose his memory and let the guy live his life because he is not about this life. Like, this does not end well for Jacob in any way. Like, give the guy his life back.
I liked in the first one that he was kind of... I liked that he was a little bit of a surrogate for the audience. Like, what is this crazy thing happening? Yeah, so I wish that they would lean more into that. Like, every time we're thinking, what is this that's happening? Or what is that spell? Where did that come from? Or why didn't it... You're a wizard. Why didn't you just use a port key in the first place? Or I wish he was kind of a voice for the audience and what we're all thinking. But,
and yet they still did the same thing where it's like, he's going to go into the briefcase and he's going to be like, it was like, I don't know what to expect, you know? And you're just like, we already did this.
We did this.
You can't keep playing the same trick. Yet, but he knows now, going through the briefcase is going to be a bad time. I mean, it will not be fun.
He might get eaten by an animal. Who knows?
One other thing for me in salvaging it, it is bringing in a different, we do need to bring in a different Grindelwald. And I actually do like the idea of just doing a different one for each film. I mean, make him a shapeshifter. I don't know, whatever. Like, just bring in a different actor. Like, there's plenty of good actors that could fill this role. Let's give them all a shot. Aaron, do you have any prescriptions to offer JK for the,
next one? To fix the next
she
one specifically.
Listening.
I know, she's a big fan. She's a contributor on our Patreon as well. To fix this third one, just give me 2 hours of that Roomba, the original Roomba machine. They're running through the hallways of that what was that place called? Oh man,
Hogwarts? Like
the library. The library. There's this like sweeping machine that was cleaning up messes in the hallways.
Oh, that's right.
It was like a little robot. Had some brushes attached to it.
No, that's great. I know exactly what you're talking about now because I do own a Roomba myself. Mm-hmm. Huge fan of them. In a world of magic, by the way, I'm like 100% confident they have a spell that does the Roomba job in like a second.
Totally unnecessary to have a robot clean up the halls.
Contraption to like.
Yeah, basically, there's no way to salvage this series for me. So I got nothing.
Oh, it's done.
I have absolutely nothing. It's dead to me. I'll still watch the other ones.
Is there any way that don't finish all five? Like, is there any way they don't?
There is a way. Like, if we see the box office returns like this one, if it keeps diminishing, yeah, we don't see all five.
But this one's still going to make money. It just pales in comparison.
And the global box office for it has been good.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Not good enough, though.
I don't know what deal they worked out with J.K. Rowling, but I think now that they have it all set in motion, it's kind of, if she has it planned out into those five movies, which I'm assuming she does, I think it's going to be hard to undo it and just stop. I mean, it has happened, but I don't know.
I don't know. After watching the second one, I'd be surprised if she did have all five planned out.
Can she turn them?
She has maybe some overarching things, maybe a couple more reveals, but like, maybe I turn it into like a comic book or questions. Something. Yeah.
See, I think it's the opposite. I think
in graphic novel form.
Yeah.
I think she has it planned out, but I didn't think she knew how to work in all the pieces she wanted into a cohesive story for this movie. I don't know. Well, time will tell.
Well, I'm fascinated to hear people's takes about this, both Potterheads and non-Potterheads, because it's been it's an interesting reaction, though I would say overwhelmingly negative. But almost in a weird, frustrating negative. Like, it wasn't just like, oh, that was just a bad movie. It was just like people were aggravated at the reasons it frustrated them. You know, it was, they spend so much time fleshing this thing out, and they spend all the money, and they put these things together. And when the story is completely non-existent, like this one, it's just the exposition and setup is, just not good storytelling. So anyway, anyone listening, if you disagree, please message us. Even though you're probably wrong with your take, we want to hear it nonetheless. Now, those listening on the audio pod, I introduced to you Beamort right after this, who will take it away with his hot takes. But thanks, Shannon, for coming on.
You're welcome.
Shannon, it's probably worth plugging that you are on the Pop Culture Footnotes podcast that you co-host with your friend Courtney. I had the pleasure of being a guest on the Queen episode leading up to the film.
That's true. University.
What's the most recent episode that people should listen to? What's a good one?
We most recently did the Rocky franchise for Creed 2. We went through all of the movies and got it in at like an hour. So I was was a miracle. Because we're on 8 now with Creed 2. So
yeah,
that's a lot of movies to cover. Yeah,
the a lot of bad of movies to cover.
Yes.
Five of those.
I did not watch
great.
All of them. the premise of our podcast is to just explain like pop culture touchstones, usually in anticipation of another film that's coming out. We have done Harry Potter in the past. I'm trying to think of things coming up. We're doing a bunch of Christmas stuff, like It's a Wonderful Life will be coming up, and The Nutcracker. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Hey, great.
It's a fun time.
We'll look out for the Christmas one. Aaron, what's your favorite Christmas movie? You should.
It's the new one that just came out on Netflix with Kurt Russell as Santa Claus. I don't know the name of it, but I've seen the commercials, I've seen the billboards, and I love Kurt Russell. So that's my favorite.
I'm pretty convinced outside of Die Hard that there's not a Christmas movie that you enjoy.
No. Do you remember the
he's going to go with the Kurt Russell Netflix one. He's going to do it.
Do you remember the sketch TV show Mad TV?
Of course.
Okay. So they had a Christmas episode where they retold the story of the Godfather using the old clay animation Rudolph story.
Oh.
Rudolph the Red. It's incredible. You can find it on YouTube. It's very funny.
Okay.
And I would recommend watching that instead of any other Christmas movie.
We will do that. No. Mad
TV.
Godfather claymation retelling.
That sounds
Rudolph. Yep. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Well, thanks to the two of you for joining the Potter Talk. And at least I get some solace in knowing that I'm not alone in my grievances. And hopefully they can right the ship. And speaking of righting the ship of this pod, here's Beamort.
Hello, this is Brian Mortensen. I was asked to call in to talk a little bit about why I liked The Crimes of Grindelwald. First, I just want to acknowledge I understand that lots of people did not like this movie, and I can even appreciate why. I can admit right from the beginning that it's not exactly a good movie. That being said, I really enjoyed it, and I think it is one of the best additions to the Harry Potter lore and universe that we've gotten so far, ever since the books ended. And I'll tell you a little bit why. So the biggest, I think, complaint from Potterheads about this movie is that it breaks canon. I really question this. It doesn't actually break canon. And I'm just going to go through some of the ways that it doesn't, even though people think it does. People are upset that Jacob remembers the events of the first movie because he was obliviated in the first movie. But Jacob remembers the good parts of the previous movie because he wasn't actually obliviated. The magic that the Thunderbird uses to obliviate the population only erases the bad memories of what happened. And beyond that, we know that love magic overpowers all other kinds of magic, including the killing curse. It can prevent, cancel out that magic. So the combination of it not actually being obliviating spell, it's actually just a substance that has obliviative properties, and also the fact that he was so in love with Queenie, I think those two combined makes it easy to see how it doesn't break canon for him to remember. Nagini was secondary character. Again, I understand this one. I think they probably cut a lot of her out of this after the backlash of her being an Asian woman. But are anybody under the impression that she will not be important later in the story? I think that her story will definitely probably be a pretty dark story as she slowly just turns into a snake. And, you know, one part of this movie that was very interesting to me is she stood on that bridge at Hogwarts, you know, feet from where she would eventually die, or at least the snake that she became die. I understand the criticism there, but I thought this is a good kind of introduction to her as she becomes more important in later movies. People seem to be upset about apparition onto school grounds, which, again, happens in the Potter movies a lot. And yeah, we should be mad about it. But at least they make them appear on the bridge and then walk in. So there is an acknowledgement that you can't apparate directly into the school, but you're not supposed to even apparate anywhere in the school grounds. Kind of ruins some of what the book 6 gets into. But again, this is the movie version, and if you're just thinking of this as a movie universe, that aligns with what we've seen in the movies before. The next is the case for McGonagall's age. Everyone says, oh, McGonagall was, you know, born 8 years before this movie, but we don't actually get that. What we get is a telling of her when she taught at Hogwarts, and people have kind of pieced that together. There's a really good article that kind of goes through how she could have actually been teaching at Hogwarts right now and then left. Supposedly, I guess I would make the guess that she's going to leave in the next movie to help with what's going on in this war. But she tells Dolores Umbridge she's only been a teacher at Hogwarts for 35 years. And so if you said, oh, 35 years ago is when she first started, but I think that's 35 years in total. And there's a really good Pottermore writing about McGonagall, which is where a lot of this comes from, but it never specifically gives us her age. So I think a lot of the conjecture about McGonagall being canon-breaking, and I don't think it is. But we'll guess, we'll see on that one. So why the ending of the movie might be a lie. There's a couple of ways that you can take the end of this movie, just literally that Albus has a younger brother. What's hard about this is that his mom died, and even if his mom didn't die, a baby she would have with someone besides Percival wouldn't technically be a Dumbledore. And then Percival is in Azkaban, and so how would he have a brother? Now, whether or not that is technically true, I think the movie wants us to not know exactly how that's true. It'll tell us later. But why it might be a lie, I think a lot of people say, well, Grindelwald could be lying. I don't think Grindelwald is lying. I think that Dumbledore might have given this lie to Grindelwald in some fashion. And the Phoenix being there at the end is supposedly proof of Dumbledore's blood running through Credence's veins, right? Being a Dumbledore. But the blood pack magic, which we'll talk to about later, it actually could be there for Grindelwald. I mean, we don't see the bird until Grindelwald is on the top of that rooftop with Credence. That bird only appears in the movie when Grindelwald is around. A lot of people said that this means that Grindelwald is, you know, has an illusion of the bird to Credence. But I would say, no, I think that's Fox. For sure that's Fox. But it's presenting himself maybe to Grindelwald as opposed to Credence. Anyways, The ending could also technically be true, but simply that the Obscuro that's inside of Credence is actually the one that was inside of Ariana Dumbledore, and that we'll get further explanation of how that process happens. Because we're told in this movie that Dumbledore sent Newt to New York, and likely to chase down Credence because of the Obscurus. So the Obscurus is an important aspect of this. It's, we assume the way that Grindelwald thinks that he can kill Dumbledore is with the Obscuro. How did Grindelwald get the Elder Wand? I agree that it's not great that we don't know how Grindelwald got the Elder Wand from between the last movie and this movie, or whatever, you know, just a throwaway line explaining that. But I think it's interesting that in the Mirror of Erised, during Dumbledore's looking into the mirror, he sees himself holding the Elder Wand, which is interesting because I think a lot of people took that seem to mean, oh, this is a memory that the mirror is playing back. But that's not how the mirror works. The mirror gives us the deepest desire of their hearts. So maybe in that case, the Elder Wand is something that Dumbledore wants. But also, perhaps that Grindelwald got the Elder Wand from Dumbledore, was given to him. But again, we see Grindelwald still the Elder Wand, so this doesn't completely compute. So lastly, a lot of people are saying, well, isn't Tina really the master of the Elder Wand because she disarmed Grindelwald at the end of the last movie? But I think this movie does a good job of showing that he meant to get caught, I believe, and to gain followers in America. I think that's kind of his MO, is he wants to play the victim. That's why when he takes over the carriage in the beginning of the movie, he allows a couple people to live to show that he has mercy, even though he doesn't. He's just playing that up. So I don't buy that the Elder Wand isn't Grindelwald's, because again, he would have to have been truly disarmed, which I don't think at that point he was. I thought he allowed himself to be captured. So either Leda or Credence must be alive at the end of this movie. Because we know that the Lestrange line actually continues, because that's how we get Bellatrix, who's not actually a Lestrange, she's a Black, but she married a Bellatrix. So one of those two people is still alive. And I think that's important to remember. There's a line in this movie where Grindelwald says to Leda, hey, Grindelwald says, come home. You were hated among witches and wizards, but not with us. Come home. And you could take that as just kind of high-minded speech, but I kind of feels like there might be a little bit of a relationship between Leda and Grindelwald. He recognizes her immediately. So I think that might be explored more. And if she's still alive, she is possibly double agent something. Anyways, I don't think there's a great chance that she's still alive, but I do think there's a good chance that there's more to her and her story than meets the eye. Jacob seeing Hogwarts at the end, a lot of people really upset that Jacob could see Hogwarts at the end of the movie. But if you look in that scene, on my third viewing, if you look at that scene, you'll see he looks very confused. And again, if you were just looking straight forward and saw two people standing in midair, you might have that look. But again, he's seen a lot of magic at this point. But I don't think you can assume that he can see Hogwarts. Okay. All of the family backstories being a big part of this movie, I guess those are all of the, it doesn't break canon. This is just general things that people didn't like, that the family backstories make for a boring movie. But as a Potterhead, I loved all that. I loved all of the discussions of Corvus Lestrange and all of the backstory there. I love the shipwreck. I think this is a wonderful addition to the plot. A lot of people said that, why are they calling it Fantastic Beasts? The beasts aren't essential. That's, I think, ludicrous. The beasts are very central in this movie. Without the beasts, they would still be in that underwater or underground cell without picking the lock. They wouldn't have got from the Ministry of Magic to Grindelwald's rally without the giant Zau, or the big cat one. And then the Niffler at the end is literally the most important thing that happened in this movie, is that the Niffler stole the blood pack. So as far as like crucial to the plot, the beasts are very crucial. And they introduced a ton of new beasts. A lot of people are like, there's not new beasts. There was a ton of new beasts in this movie. I mean, all of the beasts in the circus, all of the beasts in Newt's basement, all of the beasts that we see even in the Ministry of Magic, those spirit cats. There's a lot of good beasts in this movie. And lastly, a lot of people say this movie is too full to be a good movie. And I actually agree with this. It's not a great movie. And I think that the mistake here is that Warner Brothers should have made this into a TV series. But even as a TV series, it might not be great. But if this was a book and written out like Harry Potter books were, it would be in my top three. It would be this, the Half-Blood Prince and Deathly Hallows. That would be my top three favorite Harry Potter stories, because I think the story is very strong. Okay, so things I like about the movie, not just responding to criticism. I love the Dumbledore depiction. I thought it was pitch perfect. And for the first time in a movie, Dumbledore was actually depicted as Dumbledore is supposed to be depicted. I love how it was Dumbledore that sent Newt to New York, underlying how this franchise will also be a chess game between Dumbledore and a dark wizard, just like Harry Potter was. Newt's basement is wonderful. It's just a fun section to watch in that movie, just seeing all of the different beasts and all of the magic that he'd have to do with Fidelius Charms, or not Fidelius Charms, but expanding charms, just like we see in the tent in the forest in Deathly Hallows. So we get some really new, interesting magic in this movie. I love the Order of the Phoenix book that La Femme looks into to talk, like kind of like early forerunners to the portraits in Dumbledore's office. The tracing magic Newt uses to find Tina, I thought that was cool. And that wicked blue fire at the end of the movie, which it could be fiend fire, like we see in the seventh Harry Potter. But I kind of think not. I think there's something going on there. A lot of people have speculated that maybe that fire actually doesn't kill people. It just transports them back to Nurmagard Castle, which of course becomes a prison later in the series, rivaling Azkaban. Which again, that might be one way that Leta lives, is that she's actually just captured. I love that this movie didn't try to hold your hand. It was not trying to keep up with casual fans. It just is like, listen, if you don't get what's going on here, then it's on you. And some people who will hear me say that is like, that's a bad excuse for a bad movie. It is not a great movie, but it is a really good Potter story. the Newt, Tina, and Leta and Theseus love two triangle situation is very interesting and dramatic in ways Harry Potter has never really been. And speaking of that, the depiction of powerful wizards using the full force of their magic is always appreciated. We got some of that in the first Fantastic Beasts, and here it's just even amplified even more. The gloves are off. It's not seeing this world through teenage wizards' eyes. It's seeing it through adults' eyes. I love the exploration of other magical societies outside of England. Love the French depiction of the French Ministry of Magic, that magical Paris, like that they go into like an alternate world where in that square behind the statue. I loved that Queenie decided to go to the dark side and her motivations. I think that Grindelwald targeted her from the last new movie because we know that Abernathy worked with Tina and Queenie. And he's now an acolyte. And I think that this movie, a lot of the plot here is actually a setup for Queenie to come over, because it's important to have a powerful legilimens like her. And you see it at the end of the movie. She is reading Credence's thoughts. And a lot of people even speculate, maybe not even just Credence's thoughts, but his Obscurus's thoughts. But I really like that. I thought it made sense that why she would choose to do that. I think that it's kind of alluded or foreshadowed in the fact that she has Jacob under a spell. She is into using her power to get what she wants, even though, you know, for the greater good. And then very interesting to think that Grindelwald and his followers are kind of helping her see that, like blocking her out as an accomplished Occlumens. You kind of get that feeling. So I love the depiction of a competent and clever villain, not just a hyper evil snake man like Voldemort is. I think Grindelwald is a much more interesting villain. The Dumbledore relationship with Grindelwald is very interesting and mysterious, and I can't wait for them to explore it more. It could have been more explicitly about how they're gay, but I guess it makes sense. The visual effects were breathtaking. The introduction of the Blood Pack is as interesting as compared to the Unbreakable Vow, and they're compared in contrast in this movie. I really like that. The vacuum that cleans up the outdroppings in the Ministry of Magic is a callback to when Arthur Weasley is talking about the mess they used to make and then why they went to paper airplanes. I love the boldness in which J.K. put World War II imagery in the movie, and how Grindelwald uses the war to make the argument that humans will harm magical society if they do nothing. I really like that. I thought that was awesome. Very bold, but very cool. I love Leta saying I love you to who we don't really know. One of the brothers, both of the brothers. Very interesting. The way that the fire can determine loyalty, similar to how Peter Pettigrew's hands work, and that it fries that non-loyal acolyte of Grindelwald's when he tries to enter the flames. The way that Lita's terrible act of switching those babies is foreshadowed by her boggart, which is just a floating sheet, and we don't understand why that is, but later it's explained really like that. The way that Dumbledore and Lita discuss the loss of their siblings, very compelling. I loved that scene. And then acknowledging that the Imperius curse would likely be used for rape in the real world. I think that was interesting. Again, bold, but kind of a more mature movie anyway. I liked that that was brought up. So that's all a bunch of reasons I really like this movie. I understand why people can disagree, and I understand why people say it's not a good movie, and I can kind of agree with them. This should have been like an HBO series. One thing I think that was very bad, is that Johnny Depp didn't need to be in this movie. We should have just got Colin Farrell to do it. He was great. There's no reason that we needed Johnny Depp. When I told that to someone the other day, they said, well, yeah, but, you know, the accent. And I was like, well, Colin Farrell's Irish. He could do an accent. He's an actor. Anyways. So that's the reasons I love the movie. That's the reasons I don't think that it broke canon. And I have a feeling, much like Empire Strikes Back or The Last Jedi, as the movies continue, this will look less and less bad as we go on. So thanks for having me on, and talk to you guys later. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Brave Little Podcast. Hold on to your butts.